You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 23rd of May 2017 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Tom Edwards. On today's programme, as the UK experiences the worst terror attack in more than a decade, we'll get the latest analysis from our correspondents in the field and experts here in the studio. Monocle's Chris Lord is in Manchester.
I'm here on the streets of Manchester where this terrible terror attack took place last night. I've been here all day talking to people affected by the tragedy, and I'll let you know what they said.
More from Chris in Manchester shortly. We'll also hear how governments respond to such attacks from Lord West, the UK's former counter-terror minister.
What the government needs to know very quickly is this the first of a series of attacks? If it's not, then what you want to know is, right, can we find out who the perpetrator is? Has he got any links? Did we know about him already? Is he part of some network? Is that network going to be planning to do other things?
More from Lord West later as well. That's all ahead today on a special edition of Midori House with me, Tom Edwards. A warm welcome to today's programme. My guests on the programme are Mary Dejeski, columnist for The Independent and The Guardian, and Geoffrey Howard, lecturer in political theory at University College London. We begin the show with more information on the attack in Manchester, which killed 22 people and injured dozens more. Police have just named the suspected suicide bomber as Salman Abedi, a man in his early 20s, born in Manchester to a family of Libyan origin. We're going to delve more into that in a moment. But first, let's get the view from Manchester. Monocle's Chris Lord has been reporting from the city all day, and he joins us again on the line. Now, good evening to you, Chris. Maybe just bring us up to speed with where you are. You've been out in the city today talking to people who've been affected by this. What are people saying to you?
Well, hello, Tom. Yeah, I'm actually just on the corner of Albert Square, which is just in front of the town hall in the centre of Manchester. And a vigil has just begun here, called by the mayor of the city, Andy Burnham. Thousands of people here, actually, right now. Lots of people have been following them with bouquets of flowers down to the town hall to come and pay their respects to what happened last night. I think probably the overriding theme of talking to people today is that, you know, Manchester is a city that really prides itself on a sense of community, despite being a very large city here in the UK. It prides itself on being able to absorb situations like this, being able to get through them. It's no stranger to terror attacks. I mean, the last one was some years ago in 1996 when the IRA attacked the Arndale Centre in the centre of town. But it is no stranger to them in that sense. And lots of people that I spoke to today remembered how that event cleared out the city centre, and that they said tonight, actually, what people are going to do, rather than empty and flee the city centre and not go out tonight, they're actually going to come out and have some beers and try and bring the city through this awful event.
And Chris, I'm sure many people would admire that sort of sanguine spirit. But what about the nature of the attack? It's interesting making comparisons to that 1996 incident. I don't think there were any fatalities this day. So many, of course, last night, and so many young people, children, they're starting to identify now, kids 8 years old. Is there a worry that there's simply a gravity to this situation, which means it is unprecedented, and which means that, you know, it'll be a challenge even for those hardy folk that you describe to try and get over and move on with?
A gravity of the situation absolutely has floored people here in Manchester, I think. From I've been all over the city today talking to different people, from people who run museums here to also, you know, people who also have performance venues who are thinking about whether this is going to affect the number of people who feel that they want to go out and watch events here in a city that, you know, does pride itself on its entertainment, on its nightlife. And also, you know, people who run these bars, which I've been speaking to today, and they all say, we just can't believe the age of the people, the fact that someone would target an event like this that so clearly was, had such a huge number of very, very young people attending it. It really has floored the city. It remains to be seen how the city weathers this, but as I'm looking around me right now, as I say, thousands of people out here to show their support, to show that they're not cowed, have come out on the streets. The mayor, as I mentioned, Andy Burnham, is here, part of this vigil, and they'll be looking now, this city, as much as there is a sense of community here, and, you know, let's sort of dust ourselves off and can push on. There will also be, you can just hear behind me now, a round of applause for people as this vigil begins near here. You know, but also I think people will be looking to the government and to the security services to ensure that they feel safe in this city, so that the city can continue as it does do.
Chris Lord in Manchester, thanks for being with us on Midori House. As I mentioned, I'm here with Mary Dajewski and Geoffrey Howard in the studio, and I'll bring them in now. Geoffrey, it's interesting, we've mentioned the identification of this attacker as a young man in his early 20s, Manchester born, as we understand it. And it is interesting if we put that in the context of Chris's remarks there about the warmth of Manchester and the community spirit, then this is somebody, it's one of their own, who has perpetrated this extraordinary act. Another dimension, another level of complexity to an already incredibly fraught and difficult situation.
It's startling that someone could come out of a community that's so warm, so loving, so tolerant, so pluralist, and yet become the kind of person who could perpetrate such an act of unspeakable depravity. What makes me perplexed about this event is that it doesn't even fit into any plausible moral narrative. Attacking innocent children celebrating an event, even if you think that the UK government is perpetrating atrocities abroad, and so in some sense the citizens of Britain are responsible for these atrocities, and you want to punish these citizens in order to get them to stop perpetrating these atrocities, how is targeting innocent children who aren't responsible for anything that, in this case, Islamic State might have a problem with, going to accomplish anything? Now, Islamic State, of course, has taken responsibility for this, but we just still don't know whether this is a so-called lone wolfman or whether instead there's been some coordination. Given that it was an improvised explosive device, there was a bit of intelligence that had to go in to the design of this device. This wasn't simply a matter of driving a bus into a crowd or using a knife, as we've seen in past incidents. So the police, of course, are going to continue looking. But no, to be sure, this is a startling development out of Manchester.
And Mary, that's an interesting point, isn't it? It did feel, we were talking earlier in the day with some of our regular contributors about the fact this feels like a new low almost. We've talked so before about the callousness, the cold-heartedness of attacks, but when there's an attack, you know, which, as Geoffrey says there, it's difficult. A life lost in terror is equal to any other life lost in terror, but does this feel like a change to you, a shift in the narrative?
Well, I mean, to an extent it does, at least for this country. But I think in some ways it reflects what will be claimed as the huge success of security services in the UK, that this is actually the first time an attack using explosives has happened, actually since the car bomb attack on Glasgow Airport, which was 2 years after 7/7 in London, so 2007. So we're talking 10 years. And as Geoffrey just mentioned, there have been other attacks, but people have had to resort to other things. Explosives have been sort of either impossible to obtain or not the, as it were, the weapon of choice. So I think that to that extent, we're looking at, or at least a revival qualitatively in terms of the methods used or obtained. But I think there's also, you know, we can look across at Paris and see parallels here with the Bataclan attack, that there were people, young people mainly, enjoying themselves out for the evening, in a way that maybe seemed somehow unacceptable or something that needed to be targeted in the eyes of the person who was doing it. And so I think that, you know, it maybe not something completely new. It's not a completely new turn of events. There are parallels. But of course, for this country and for Manchester, you know, we're used to these things happening in London. But Manchester suddenly, you know, it seems something else.
And Geoffrey, on that point, I was going to come to this later, but as Mary raises it there, what about that narrative around sort of going out into the country? I mean, there is presumably something very effective from the point of view of the perpetrator to bring the uncertainty or the question about, am I safe in my day-to-day business, away from the capital, away from high-profile targets, and indeed to look at so-called soft targets, not only around London, but out in the provinces, in another big centre. Would that have been, I mean, it's speculative, but do you think that will have been amongst their thinking to try and spread that uncertainty, maybe a bit of nervousness, more widely across the country?
Well, with respect to this individual, it makes you wonder about his relationship with the city and his attitudes toward the place that he called home. And perhaps that's more than anything else driving it in this case. We won't know until we learn more about him rather than some calculated attempt to target some small hamlet. I think what's pretty clear from this case is that it just shows us how corrosive terrorism is. I certainly agree that a life lost in a terrorist attack is just as valuable as a life lost through any other kind of horrible crime or accident. But there is something about murder through terrorism that is worse than ordinary murder, which is that it has this effect of destabilizing the entire society and making people fear that when they walk down to their local shop, when they go out for a bite to eat, when they take their kid to a concert, they might die. And that has this extraordinary consequence of destabilizing people's sense that they're safe in their own society. And I think what's really horrific about these cases of terrorism is that there's no obvious demand. It isn't give us independence. It isn't free these hostages. It isn't do this or that or that. It is killing for the sake of killing, and that's what makes it so evil.
Mary, on that point, I mean, Jeffrey talks about the inevitability then of that nervousness, of just that simple question, am I safe? Is my family safe? Can the sort of British stoicism, I mentioned it to Chris when we spoke, can that counter that? I mean, it's important to try, more important now than ever, but can it stop that? I mean, it's such an insidious fear, isn't it?
No, I think that's absolutely true. I think that so far, risk saying this now, that the UK generally, maybe because of the IRA experience, has shown an absolutely remarkable resilience on the part of the public, which is a huge asset compared with a lot of countries. And we saw this in Manchester last night, again, just as we'd seen it with the attack on Parliament a couple of months ago, just as we saw it at 7/7. There is an almost sort of superhuman response from ordinary members of the public who come out, you know, they do their first aid, they offer help, they accommodate people in their hotels, they put their taxis at the disposal of complete strangers. Last night they were all over the social media offering accommodation to people who were stranded. Now, you know, that is a fantastic thing to do in those particular circumstances.
That's resilience. And I wonder, Jeffrey, what about restraint? Because already people are asking whether it's fueled by the media or certain, as I would see it, rather undesirable elements on, say, the right-leaning elements of the press, for example. We need to see a reaction. You know, there's been people who said, you know, where's our state of emergency? Now, aside from saying, well, hang on, that just isn't the British way, are you confident that the kinds of scenes, those very positive outpourings that Mary's describing there, will continue to hold sway? Or do you worry that, perhaps understandably, some of that rhetoric, some of that demand for something more aggressive or more immediate could start to seep into the narrative in the centre?
I think it's pretty clear that journalists have an ethical duty not just to put the most sensationalist headlines on the front of their papers, but also show some of the amazing good work that has been being done in cities like Manchester in response to attacks like this. I think it's also important to recognize the good work being done by the security services. So Sir Michael Fallon in March suggested that at least a dozen terrorist plots were foiled just last year. And so I think the security services are doing a very, very good job. And as Mary was saying, this is the first attack of this kind we've had for a long while in this country. And I think that's partly because of all of these attacks that are being foiled behind the scenes that the men and women of the security services are making possible.
Well, on that point about the media and, you know, this undeniable duty of care or to report accurately, to report not on rumours but on facts, there nevertheless remains this question about reporting, whether it can do more harm than good at times. We posed that question a little earlier to Dr. Sally Leavesley, Director of New Risk, which advises companies and governments on counterterrorism and public protection. Let's hear a little of what she had to say.
I don't think the reporting does more harm than good. The American procedure is different, where you have embedded within the police force free-speaking American reporters. And we've had exactly this same breach of information in a past sort of experience. And I spoke to that person who frightened the UK population immensely with pictures of the bombs that had been found. So it can cause fear if it's not given in context. But most of the reporting is in context. And I find that the reporters ask the questions the public want to know. And also the granular piece of information, rather than the headlines, what the reporters are picking up with the victim statements often tells us very quickly what, from the point of view of protecting the public right now, if there's another attack, I pick up what the victims are saying that tells me how we can tell them how to protect themselves. So it's that granular reporting of the detail of the human action that tells us if they're not close to glass doors at the beginning of foyers, for example, they're not going to get into that threat area.
That was Dr. Sally Leasley, Director of New Risk, which advises on counter-terror and public protection. And Mary, she raises some interesting points there, I think.
Yes.
What did you make of that?
I wanted actually to say a big thank you to Sally Leasley for not blaming the media, because it's so easy after these sort of events, and in some ways before them, to blame the media for either for creating wrong sort of atmosphere or for hindering the police operations, security operations, for generally being anti-security or whatever. And I generally don't think that's true. I think that also that when asked for particular restraint for reasons that they can understand, the media is actually very observant. And we saw this today. We also saw it with the attack on Parliament and with the arrest in Whitehall before that, that names were out there. And the media was asked not to release the names because, of course, it risked prejudicing any operations that were already in hand by the police and security services. And we saw that again today. And I think that where the media can be blamed in general, it may be for being, as it were, you could say, inflammatory on the subject of the actual perpetrators. But again, I mean, as Sally Leavesley implied, the media is reflecting back either the mood or the questions that the public want to be asked. And I think in general it does that, and it does that pretty well.
Just on one point, I guess a different facet of this media question, Geoffrey, there was some discrepancy between the US media and the UK media. The US media, briefed by US intelligence, who themselves have been briefed by their British counterparts, was quite quick to publish, well, news of this, firstly, as a terror attack, and then more details, whilst the UK media, rather as Mary said, observed a more reserved line until later. And clearly there were some people in the UK establishment who said, well, hang on, can this be right? Should the UK be lagging behind in media terms? Is that an irrelevant question to be asking in this instance?
I think perhaps in this case it was a function of, in the US, it being a foreign news story, as it were, and therefore letting itself to a slightly more cavalier attitude, given that the readers and viewers by and large weren't people who would have been directly affected by the incident or those directly worried about the innocent. But I think
also the timing meant that it was prime time in America when it happened, whereas that it was quite late at night in the UK.
I think that's right. But by and large, I think Mary's correct that people in the media world are generally doing pretty well in the UK in response to attacks like these. I think it might have been the Daily Mail in response to the Westminster attack that posted photos of the victims and said, remember them, rather than the loser, to use the word that Trump used to describe this most recent terrorist.
Well, let's get another take from one of our regular analysts here at Monocle 24. Joining us on the line now is Raffaella Pantucci, who's Director of International Security Studies at RUSI and the author of We Love Death as You Love Life, Britain's Suburban Terrorists. Raffaella, thanks for being with us on the programme. Obviously, in the last hour or so, the police have named the attacker who perpetrated this attack. What have you made both of the little that we know about him and also of this incident generally?
I mean, I think, first of all, the most striking thing is, of course, the atrocity that's been carried out. I mean, the idea of walking a bomb into a crowd of young people as they're leaving a concert seems a pretty callous act. And it's, I think, important to remember that. in the sort of midst of this incident. But I think, you know, the other aspect which is sort of striking is the fact that we see the bomb being used. I think the sort of assumption had started to develop that, you know, terrorist plotting that we were seeing was moving in a different direction, you know, towards using knives and guns and, I'm sorry, knives and cars. And the sort of idea that bombs seem to be have moved on from. But the reality is the terrorists are keen to launch attacks using whatever tools they can, and anything that will get their message across is ultimately their goal. I'm sure that as time goes on, sort of more details that are fairly similar in these incidents will start to emerge, you know, including that the individual was known to the authorities. And I think the real question is, you know, to understand now exactly what we're looking at and exactly how much this is connected or not to Islamic State.
Well, Rafael, just before I bring this back to Jeffrey and Mary here in the studio, on the point about how we move forwards, are you confident that the general approach of the security services, we've already mentioned their strong record in other preventative instances up to this point, will stand the scrutiny that's sure to follow in the days and potentially weeks ahead?
I mean, like any attack that takes place is by definition a failure of the security services. You know, the fact that the attack has taken place means that something didn't work in the system, that something was able to get through. But I think the reality is that they've been dealing with a threat tempo, you know, since 2014 that's been set at severe, which, you know, means that they expect an attack to be highly likely. And in that time, we've had, you know, three successful terrorist attacks take place. This one in Manchester, the incident in Westminster that took place, you know, what, just over a month ago, and then the murder of Joe Cox during the election campaign last year towards ahead of the Brexit vote. You know, so that's a fairly good record when we think of the comparators across on the continent and what's been sort of happening there. The other point to make is that if we look at the sort of recent past, the past few months, there has been a sort of noticeable uptick in arrests by authorities, and specifically of arrests around attack planning. So previously, you'd seen a lot of arrests happening last year and in the past few years, but it was much more about people trying to go abroad, people trying to go fight, people who were kind of, you know, a part of fundraising networks or people who were part of support networks or spreading material. And they've still seen some of those arrests in the past few months, but recently you'd seen a lot more around the sort of attack planning. And that suggests that, at least from a security theorist's perspective, they were seeing a threat picture which is going in a very sharp direction. And the question is, how long can that sort of tension and stress remain? And how long are you continuing to get it right? You know, I think it was one of the IRA leaders who back in the day said something along the lines of, you know, we only need to get it right once, you need to get it right every time. Well, that adage really sadly holds.
Indeed. Raffaello, thanks for your time. That's Raffaello Pantucci, Director of International Security Studies at RUSI. Jeffrey Howard, what about that point that, you know, any incident that occurs is necessarily a failure of the security services? I mean, that's true in black and white terms, but is that to miss some of the nuance here, do you think?
Well, clearly, insofar as the security services aspires to have no terrorist attacks, clearly it isn't fulfilling its goal when a terrorist attack transpires. Still, I think that it's impossible to live in a free society and think that the risk of terrorism that we're going to face is going to be zero. No one thinks that in a free society it's possible for the government to bring the crime rate to zero while still maintaining the character of that society as a free society. And the same goes for this particular kind of particularly insidious criminal activity, namely terrorism. Unless we want to live in a society where the police are actively, and the security services are actively surveilling hundreds, even thousands of members of the society at any given time, this is simply going to be a risk that we face. Now, that doesn't mean we can't take intelligent action to reduce our susceptibility to terrorism. But I think that security officials don't necessarily need to feel like they failed the nation just because of a loser. Again, to use the one time I think I agreed with the choice of terminology
exactly
by Donald Trump.
The conversation I had today was the first time that I thought he'd got something
This fool. Who with unbelievable cowardice, to use a term used by Prime Minister May, decides to target some teenage girls having some fun in the evening.
Mary, nevertheless, people will start to scrutinise the actions of the security services, and they'll also be watching carefully to see the government's response. If we have time, we'll hear from Lord West in a moment. But there is this broad question. Obviously, Theresa May convened COBRA and had several meetings. Does the fact that we're in well, a heightened political climate domestically here in the UK. Does that speak to this at all, or can we rely on people to be truly consensual in their approach to these sorts of issues?
Well, I think there's, there is the very specific question as to whether there was any sort of further political motive behind this attack, given the political situation currently and the election campaign ongoing in the UK. And it seems to me that probably, you know, this attack was not, it was calculated for the target and the venue. It was probably not calculated to have anything to do with the election campaign. But having said all that, I think it's going to have an effect on the election campaign. And I think, to stick my neck out a little here, it's and people have said that sort of remarks along these lines are distasteful given the current circumstances, and that to an extent that's true. But I think it is going to act to possibly the huge advantage of Theresa May and the Conservatives, because first of all, she was having a spot of difficulty in that by pure political misjudgment on her part, the agenda had shifted from Brexit to social issues, and particular social issues, and this completely yanks the election campaign back to the issues of security and international relations and the subject that Theresa May wanted to fight this election on. And as a past Home Secretary, it's been pointed out that this is one of her strengths. She's actually emerged not with huge credibility, in fact, through the election campaign on other issues, but on security, on her former Home Office portfolio. She comes out, and we saw her again today when she produced her prime ministerial response. She carries enormous conviction, and I think this is going to work hugely in her favour.
Geoffrey, it just strikes me, is our political, our current political narrative mature enough? Is it grown up enough to tackle these kinds of issues? We know that there are rabble-rousers, if you want, on the right of the media, and to be fair, in the political firmament as well, in Westminster and in Brussels to some degree. Is our narrative robust enough to ask the trenchant questions and actually make progress here? Or do you worry that there are enough people willing to seek to profit from this, maybe politically or whatever it might be, that might start to challenge that consensus?
I worry about it enormously. I mean, we haven't had an intelligent discussion about this in this country, about the prevent strategy and whether the prevent strategy is counterproductive, which features of the prevent strategy are working, which features aren't working. Is it doing more harm than good, alienating particular communities? Is it appropriate for the police to be actively involved in this strategy? There are very important questions we need to ask about this, and there are real disagreements between the political parties on it. But again, the mantra of strong and stable leadership, I think, is going to sound really nice to a lot of people after last night. And I don't begrudge Theresa May for a moment in looking very prime ministerial today, but boy, does she look very prime ministerial.
And it could be politically expedient rather than politically opportunistic, simply to try and push that agenda, I guess. We're almost out of time, but I just wanted to ask you briefly, Geoffrey, before the end. You were interested as well in sort of counter-terror, the ethics around that, and also counter-radicalisation. Not to preempt what will surely emerge about the alleged perpetrator in the next 24 hours. Again, are we primed for a change of narrative now about how people are getting into this position because of the detail, even the limited detail we know about Salman Abedi at this stage?
I think it's becoming increasingly clear that there's no one trajectory that a person goes through in order to wind up committing a terrorist attack of this kind, and we need to ultimately be very open-minded and defend our values. And I think that people who are tempted by these doctrines, tempted by the ideas that move people to perpetrate crimes like this, need a forum of freedom of expression in which people can vocally and powerfully argue against them.
But it also has to be said that his profile, insofar as we know it, as being somebody who grew up in this country, but of parents who came here into exile from a Muslim country, that is actually quite a familiar profile from the 7/7 bombers. We saw it. We've also seen it quite a lot in some of the attacks in France, including the very early attacks by Algerian exiles. When I was based in Paris in the 1990s.
Indeed. Mary Dujeski and Geoffrey Howard, it's been a pleasure talking to you. Thanks so much for your time today. That's all we have time for on Midori House. The show was produced by Daniel Giacopelli and researched by Yolene Goffin and Hunter Charlton, and our studio manager was Kieran Banerjee. We'll have more music. We'll have our Section D design programme at 1900. For more on all of the day's main news and to hear more from Chris and our other guests and the latest on the Manchester attack, stay tuned for the Monocle Daily. That's coming your way at 2200 hours London time. Midori House is back at the same time tomorrow, 1800 here in London. From me, Tom Edwards, and the rest of the team, thank you very much for tuning in.